From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill on The Miracle Hunter. Hey, we've got a great show ahead for you today. We talk a lot on this program about the light versus the dark, the good versus the bad, the spiritual warfare that's out there. But we have one of the top experts on spiritual warfare joining us on today's program, and that's author Dan Burke. He's also the president of the Avila Institute. He's going to be talking about his new book, Finding Peace in the Storm. And also this past week was the feast day of St. Margaret Mary Ellicott. Of course, she's the visionary of those Sacred Heart visions that happened in Paray-le-Monial in France. And we'll be joined by Emily Jaminet, the author of Holy Habits from the Sacred Heart. She'll be telling us about how we can incorporate these visions, these messages of St. Margaret Mary into our own daily lives. And check out on my program this week, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, this week, Paray-le-Monial. That's where I explore in a visit to Paray-le-Monial in France, where St. Margaret Mary first experienced the dramatic visions of Jesus' Sacred Heart. I'll be exploring the origins of this cherished devotion. It's one of my favorite episodes. And this week, next week on They Might Be Saints, on Wednesday at 8 a.m. Central Time, 9 a.m. Eastern, we've got They Might Be Saints with Father Augustus Tolton. I'll be examining the sainthood cause of the first black priest in American history, Venerable Augustus Tolton, who overcame tremendous challenges, both inside and outside the Catholic Church. So check that one out. They Might Be Saints next week, 8 a.m. on Wednesday. Later in the show, we'll be looking like we always do at the 365 Days with Mary project. For today, we've got Our Lady of the Rosary from Neapoli in Italy in the 17th century. And the Might Be Saint of the Day, Blessed Charles of Austria, feast day, October 21st, who lived from 1887 to 1922. The question of the week is an interesting one. Are there any living stigmatics? I'll do my best to answer that question in just a little bit. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we look at the miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And this is a place that I traveled to just last month, Our Lady of Aparecida in Brazil. Brazil has inaugurated a giant statue of Our Lady of Aparecida. And for those people who don't know, Brazil is the land of giant statues. Of course, you know Cristo Redentor, and even bigger, this St. Rita of Cassia statue and various other statues all throughout the land. But there's a brand new one dedicated to the patroness of Brazil. That's Our Lady of Aparecida. So located in Sao Paulo, the statue is 164 feet tall and is amongst the largest religious monuments in Brazil and in the world. In the lead up to this past October 12th, the day the church celebrates the patron saint of Brazil, devotees received a treat in the first phase of a grand monument in honor of Our Lady of Aparecida was inaugurated in the city of Aparecida in the southern Brazilian state of Sao Paulo. The sculpture is made of steel, weighs 400 tons, is 164 feet high, and it puts this monument on the list of the largest religious images in the world. And it costs an estimated 10 million Brazilian reals, nearly 2 million U.S. dollars. And it's located in the Itagaku neighborhood, 2 miles from the National Shrine of Aparecida, where I went recently. And it will certainly become another tourist attraction in the city, which receive millions of pilgrims and tourists every year. In my opinion, it's something of a Lourdes of South America. It's absolutely amazing. And sculptor Gilmar Pina, he designed the monument, which has not yet been completed. He says, quote, "We're still going to add a giant map of Brazil held up by the two arms of God. Each arm will be 62 feet long, and the sculpture will be 50 meters high, will weigh 60 tons, said the sculptor. And the work on the second phase of the project is expected to take another year. You know, the statue in honor of Our Lady of Aparecida, announced in 2017, has been the subject of legal disputes. An association of atheists and agnostics succeeded in having the work on the monument temporarily suspended, and the association claimed that the municipality could not invest public money to benefit just one religion. But after several legal appeals, the municipality was granted permission to resume work on the giant statue in 2022, and the image was inaugurated on October 7th of this year. the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary during a Mass. And so check out my Facebook page for photos of this giant statue in progress there in Brazil in Aparecida. For more miracle news, go to my Facebook page of The Miracle Hunter, where each and every day we post events happening all around the world. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give it a prize, the Miracle Hunter image of the faces of Mary. And people who know me know I love pub trivia, so on a random night you might find me in a bar somewhere playing pub trivia, but this is Catholic Pub Trivia. Last week we spoke with David Carollo from the World Apostolate of Fatima about the Fatima Sun Miracle. You can go to the EWTN.com/radio or download the free EWTN app to listen to that great interview. And so the question last week related to Our Lady of Fatima, kind of a funny one in some ways, but what outfit was Mary wearing during her final apparition? That was October 13th, 1917. The answer to that was she was dressed as Our Lady of Mount Carmel. And writing in with that correct answer was Jean Smith from Houston, Texas. She wins the prize. We'll be sending her out the image of the faces of Mary. And this week, we're talking today with Emily Jaminet about the Sacred Heart Devotion and St. Margaret Mary Olakoke, whose feast day was just this week. And the question is, what was the name of St. Margaret Mary's Olakoke spiritual director, who was also a saint? We're looking for the saintly spiritual director of St. Margaret Mary. I love when the saints hang out with other saints. It's a fun thing that happens in history. If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and we'll see if you're the fastest with the right answer. And answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Emily Jaminet, author of Holy Habits from the Sacred Heart, about St. Margaret Mary Olakoke, whose feast day was just this week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who tune into the show know I talk a lot about my Explore with the Miracle Hunter series. And coming up this week, we have the episode related to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, Pere Lemoniel. That is the site of those visions of St. Margaret Mary Olakoke. And it was her feast day just this past week as well. So this is the perfect time to talk about the Sacred Heart, one of the most famous devotions in the history of Catholicism. And who better to talk to than our go-to person for the Sacred Heart? That's Emily Jaminet. She's the author of Holy Habits from the Sacred Heart from Ave Maria Press and the executive director of the Sacred Heart Enthronement Network. You can check out her site, welcomehisheart.com. And we welcome Emily back to the program today. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Hello, Michael. Thanks for having me. And I too am excited that this past week we celebrated the feast of St. Margaret Mary, her feast day, and then also actually the day that she passed as well, which is October 17th. So it's a big day, and she's an important saint. So if you haven't had a chance to get to know her, I can't say enough about her piety, her holiness, and the tremendous mission she had, and that was to promote and share the love of Christ with others through devotion to the Sacred Heart. St. Margaret Mary was born July in 1647, and she had a very ordinary childhood in many ways, but they said that she really was a very virtuous child. She was modest, she was virtuous, she was holy, and she had quite a few obstacles as a child as well. Her father died when she was young. She was paralyzed and suffered from illness from 9 to 13, and they even said that when she was young and suffering, she gave her life in a special way to the Blessed Mother and said, if you heal me, I will go on and become a religious sister. Well, she was healed, and, you know, she went then kind of living an ordinary life, but then the Lord got her attention in a very special way, and she ended up coming back to that understanding and that hearing that call to religious life. And she decided to join the convent around the age of 22. And quite an extraordinary life that she had as a religious. She joined the Visitation Order. And actually, 2 days after Christmas in 1673, St. Margaret, at the time Sister Margaret, explained that Jesus appeared to her in a very extraordinary way. It's hard to imagine.
What was that vision like? I know she had many visions throughout the course of her life, some of them very dramatic, revealing the heart of Christ in flames. What was this first vision like?
You know what? It's so unique because, Michael, that first vision, you know, for many of us, we might be thinking 2 days after Christmas, what's going on, you know, 2 days after Christmas, maybe putting the Christmas tree, making sure it's all set and putting the wrapping away. But it's actually a very important feast day, the Feast of St. John, the beloved apostle. And as we know in Scripture, St. John is such an important apostle because of his relationship with Jesus Christ. He, you know, is the beloved apostle. He was there. He had the strength, the grace, the union with Christ to be at the foot of the cross, and then to continue that tremendous mission of sharing the love of Christ. So St. John was, that feast day is very significant for us as Catholics. But as you said, you know, what's also special about that first feast day is Jesus called St. Margaret Mary the disciple of the Sacred Heart. So I'm sure that was a little bit intimidating, having this vision of Jesus appearing with his heart outside his body, inviting her to be the disciple of the Sacred Heart. But yet, looking back, we can say, thank God she said yes, and she accepted all of these beautiful gifts of living this devotion and sharing this devotion.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Emily Jaminet, the author of Holy Habits from the Sacred Heart from Ave Maria Press. And when we talk about the further visions of St. Margaret Mary and the eventual acceptance of these visions by the Catholic Church, how did the Sacred Heart devotion develop or emanate from what she experienced?
Well, at first, as you can imagine, there was a state of trying to better understand what Sister Margaret Mary was saying. There even is some writing of just the sisters not believing her, or, you know, some persecution within her own community. But thanks be to God, she had a beautiful spiritual confessors and guides, and we learned that a Jesuit priest, Father Claude de Clambere, who later became a saint, served as her spiritual director and was able to write what St. Margaret was experiencing and to sharing this devotion in a bit of a form that we can really grasp and understand now. So this form, you know, begins with visions, and you can read many of her letters and writings. But I would say now we have some key takeaways. And I would say the first takeaway is the importance of, you know, that simple act of cultivating an intimate, loving relationship with Jesus Christ, and understand the significance of the Holy Eucharist and the Sacred Heart, that it's one heart, and that this is also, you know, a devotion that brings us closer to Christ, especially through the Eucharist. So I see, you know, that's probably the first and significant takeaway, is that God loves us, and he wants to spiritually feed us and be with us through the course of our whole life.
Absolutely. And so once these visions ceased, and her spiritual director, her order, those around her began to believe, how did the church then take this from the experiences of just one humble nun to one of the greatest devotions in the history of Catholicism?
Well, what is so beautiful about this devotion and all great devotions, and why it's called the devotion, is because the foundation was always here within the church. Again, in Scripture, we know the significance of the heart of Christ. We can look at that as his heart was pierced by a sword, or, as I mentioned, St. John the Beloved resting his head on his heart. I think of that heart-to-heart with Jesus. But when it took on new form is, the church first and foremost approved what was called the votive mass of the Sacred Heart, and they started to see the significance of that piece of liturgy first being practiced in segments of the church in particular diocese, but then also being recognized as an official liturgy in the church worldwide. A second major influence of St. Margaret Mary was the beautiful 12 promises of the Sacred Heart. And if anyone has not read those, I can't say enough about, you know, diving in and coming to appreciate these beautiful 12 promises where Jesus lays out, you know, this how he wants to have an intimate connection with us, and he wants to bless us. He wants to give us grace. He wants to strengthen us. Now, what I tell people is, in her writings, there was more than just 12 promises, but these are gospel promises. What takes place when we encounter Christ in a new way and we're transformed through holiness. And also, a key component is the importance of reparation. You know, maybe we look to the world and we're overwhelmed by the state of the world, but Jesus empowers us to say, we can, you know, offer up our sufferings, our joys and sorrows through the simple act of morning offering or going to Mass and offering up our Holy Eucharist in reparation. And that really comes to life with what we call the First Friday devotion, where we're invited to go to First Friday Mass for 9 consecutive months. So that's kind of a very quick summary, but an overview, and I would say an invitation to grow closer to Jesus each and every day.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Emily Jaminet, the Executive Director of the Sacred Heart Enthronement Network and author of Holy Habits from the Sacred Heart from Ave Maria Press. And Emily, when you wrote the book Holy Habits, what was your hope in sort of analyzing this devotion, breaking it down, and presenting those things that people can do to actually make that devotion come alive in their own lives?
Well, Michael, you know, first, before I became a Catholic writer, I'm a Catholic mother, a mother of 7 children, and I just saw the importance of not just knowing my faith, but being able to live it in a way that transforms the lives of others. You know, for many of us, we long to see family members come back to the faith. We want to be that holy example, you might say, in the life of others. But what we have to do is first allow Christ to change our hearts, our perspective, so that we can go forth and share that message. So this Holy Habits is really a continuation of my first book on the Sacred Heart, Secrets of the Sacred Heart, which focuses on the 12 promises. This is focused on, you know, transforming your life so that you have more peace, that you have more spiritual stability, and you can really be a light to others.
Absolutely. And for those people who are curious, and I know you went through some of the habits that people do as far as the First Friday devotion and otherwise, what types of things do you feature as far as habits go that people can develop based on your book?
Well, you know, for many of us, when we look to the heart of Jesus, what makes this devotion so beautiful is that his heart is exposed outside his body. It's meant to bring us closer to him, the image of the Sacred Heart, that we know it pours forth grace when we look lovingly upon the image. And it's what I love to say, a holy reminder. But so the first thing I would do is recommend people, you know, having that holy reminder in their home, having an image of the Sacred Heart, because Jesus actually requested to St. Margaret Mary that the image was in the home. You know, he said that he would bless the home in which the image of the heart would be exposed and honored. So it's not just having the image on the wall, but honoring. And I can tell you that I have heard the most beautiful stories about when homes have that image up, and it's a place in predominance, it's a place of respect, and then they give their hearts to Christ, and how the Lord can act. He will act. So that's one simple act, but it leads to spiritual growth, such as, you know, he's the King of Peace, right? And what family does not want peace, does not want that peace beyond our all understanding, and that comes from accepting new graces from him as well.
Wonderful. And for people who want to find out more about your book, Holy Habits from the Sacred Heart, or your Sacred Heart Enthronement Network, or perhaps enthroning an image in their own home, what's the best place for your work that people can find out more?
I would love if people visited welcomehisheart.com, a ministry devoted to the Sacred Heart, promoting the enthronement, which is self-led and self-directed, and also they can access all my books as well.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Emily Jaminet, from the Sacred Heart Enthronement Network and author of Holy Habits from the Sacred Heart, for joining us today and telling us about the great saint, St. Margaret Mary Ellicoke, and that Sacred Heart devotion. Thank you so much for being with us on today's program.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Have a blessed and wonderful day.
God bless. That was Emily Jaminet. Check out her book, Holy Habits from the Sacred Heart, available from Ave Maria Press. You can check out her work at welcomehisheart.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to try to answer the question of the week. Are there any living stigmatics? Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. People write in with questions, and I also go around the country giving talks at different shrines and parishes and conferences, and I talk for about 45 minutes, oftentimes these days, about Eucharistic miracles, and I leave some time at the end. Sometimes it's 5 minutes, sometimes it's 25 minutes. People have questions. I'd love to hear what people are thinking about and try to answer the questions the best that I can. We have a good question this week, and it's kind of a hard one. I might not have a complete answer for you. The question is from Jim. He says, "Dear Miracle Hunter, are there any living stigmatics? Thank you, Jim." So thanks, Jim, for this question. Of course, when we're talking about stigmatics, we're talking about those people who bear the wounds of Christ. And there's a great amount of variability throughout history where we have people who have wounds in their hands or their wrists, or perhaps in their side or their feet or their back or their forehead, that supposedly correspond to the wounds of Christ's passion. And so Padre Pio perhaps is the most famous, or St. Francis of Assisi. These are the most famous stigmatics in history. But the question is, are there any living stigmatics? And we might first point to Myrna Nazur from Damascus in Syria. And perhaps she's not currently receiving the stigmata. I've met her and I've interviewed her in person. And she said that on those days when Orthodox Easter and Roman Catholic Easter coincide and happen on the same day, those were the days when her wounds would bleed. And you can actually go on YouTube and see footage of doctors examining her and the wounds opening and closing and bleeding and stopping. It's truly an amazing phenomenon. In my opinion, she is the most authentic of all living stigmatics. And then there are other people who have who are claiming the stigmata, people like Zlatko Sudac from Croatia. And we have Father Lukas Molitva in Poland. And that's a stigmata that recently started happening within the past year, as far as my understanding goes. I wasn't able to go visit him myself when I was last in Poland, but perhaps he is a case of one that has been claimed in the world today. So there may be many, many stigmatics. We don't really know, but these are three of the more famous ones, or the more popular ones that are mentioned around the world. You can go to my website, miraclehunter.com, to see the entire list of stigmatics of people who have had the wounds of Christ throughout Christian history. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary Project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day's date. Of course, you know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion that lines up to each and every day of the calendar year. And so for today's date, we've got Our Lady of the Rosary from Neapoli in Italy in the 17th century. And the story goes that the Church of Holy Mary of the Rosary, built in 1830, is located in a farmhouse in Neapoli. It was one nave and a marble altar, along with a statue of Our Lady of the Rosary from the 17th century and an earlier wooden crucifix. The community prepares for the celebration of the feast with a rosary novena that begins on October 12th in the church of her namesake. On October 20th, the Holy Rosary is followed by a prayer vigil in honor of Our Lady of the Rosary. And the townspeople gather on the 21st for a procession of votive altars and features a tarantella dance around the village. At night, a wonderful party offers food, tasting with typical local dishes, and the festa continues with music and dancing, and finishes with spectacular fireworks. And that's Our Lady of the Rosary in Neapoli in Italy. And that feast day is today, October 21st. For more information on 365 Days with Mary or any or about this fascinating devotion, go to the website, 365dayswithmary.com, or download the app or join the Facebook page of 365 Days with Mary. You can join any of the 10,000 other followers who get a daily title of Mary on their Facebook. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about those people on the path to sainthood. We're talking about servants of God, venerables, blesseds, before they have all their miracles and are declared saints by Rome. And of course, this connects with my television series, They Might Be Saints, which airs every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and my book, They Might Be Saints, which is available on EWTNRC.com. And so for today's date, we've got the Might Be Saint of the Day is Blessed Charles of Austria, whose feast day is today, October 21st, and he lived from 1887 to 1922. And Blessed Charles of Austria was born August 17, 1887, in Peresenburg in Kassel, in Melk in Lower Austria. And he was son of Archduke Otto and Princess Maria Josephine of Saxony, and he was the great-nephew of Emperor Francis Joseph I. A stigmatic nun prophesied that he would be the victim of attacks and great suffering. A group of people were specifically assigned to pray for him at all times. After his death, this group formed the League of Prayer of Emperor Charles for the Peace of the Peoples, which became an ecclesiastically recognized prayer group in 1963. He received a strong Catholic education and developed a strong devotion to the Holy Eucharist and the Sacred Heart of Jesus. He married Princess Zita of Bourbon in Parma on October 21, 1911. They had 8 children over the next 10 years. With the assassination of Archduke Francis Ferdinand on June 22, 1914, the trigger for World War I, Charles became their presumptive heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. On the death of Emperor Francis Joseph on November 21, 1916, Charles became Emperor of Austria, crowned Apostolic King of Hungary in 1916, and he saw his crown as a way to implement Christian charity and social reform. He worked for peace and an end to war, and was the only leader who tried twice in 1921 to return to power, but since he refused to be the cause of civil war, he finally gave up. Since he considered his office a mandate from God, he never abdicated his throne or title, but he was exiled to the island of Madeira in Portugal and spent his remaining days in prayerful poverty. His widow, Princess Zita, dressed in black and lived in mourning her remaining 67 years. He died on April 1, 1922, in Madeira in Portugal of pneumonia. He was declared venerable by Pope John Paul II in 2003, and on October 3, 2004, John Paul II beatified him as a blessed in our Catholic Church. With one more miracle, Blessed Charles of Austria will become Saint Charles of Austria. For more information on this future saint or any of the other future saints that we feature on our program, check out the website, theymightbesaints.com. And you can watch EWTN this week, where we have Father Augustus Tolton. Well, I'll be examining the sainthood cause of the first black priest in American history, Venerable Augustus Tolton, who overcame tremendous challenges both inside and outside the Catholic Church. That's next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on EWTN television. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about spiritual warfare with Dan Burke and his new book, Finding Peace in the Storm. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We talk a lot on the show about some of the spiritual battle that each of us goes through each and every day in our lives of faith. And some we find some moments where we're encouraged and enlightened, and other times when we are dragged down and we have doubts. We all go through a spiritual battle of one sort or another. Well, we're so excited today to talk with Dan Burke, the president of the Avila Institute for Spiritual Formation and author of the new book, Finding Peace in the Storm, Reflections on St. Alphonsus Liguori's Uniformity with God's Will. Welcome back to the program today, Dan Burke.
It's great to be back with you.
So this new book, Finding Peace in the Storm, it focuses on St. Alphonsus Liguori, specifically uniformity with God's will. For those people out there who don't know St. Alphonsus Liguori, who is the man and why did you target this book to focus your new book on that?
Well, he was born in the 17th century in Italy. At 16, he had his Doctor of Law degree, believe it or not. And but about 10 years later, he started to slip in some of his devotions. He was always holy, but he, according to him, he wasn't doing, you know, what he should do. He lost a big case at 27 that humbled him. He went to visit a sick hospital for incurables just to serve other people, and he heard the Lord say, "Leave the world behind and give thyself to me." And that same year, he entered into a seminary and was ordained a priest at 30. He founded the Congregation of the Most Holy Redeemer, which is known as the Redemptorists, in the 1800s, Bishop of Naples, patron saint of moral theologians, doctor of the church. He was a powerhouse of his time. And when you think of the great doctors of moral theology, he would be on the same page, though lower than Aquinas and Augustine. But then also, when you think of spiritual theology, he would be on the same page with Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, though also a lower part on that page. But he's quite a prominent voice in the church and has been a really beautiful gift to people of God.
Amazing. And Uniformity with God's Will. Tell us, what is that book?
So that's a letter. It's a book. It's a letter he wrote after suffering some personal tragedy and then attempting to, you know, help another to give them insight. You know, oftentimes when we hit a wall or we struggle, it's a powerful moment where when we know how to deal with it, we can reach out to others and talk about our struggles and kind of, you know, help them as we are helped. It reminds me of the first verse of the second letter of Corinthians. We help others. We comfort others with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted. And so that was the impetus for the book. Fundamentally, what his message is that God is present. He's at work in all things, that he either causes or allows all things. And when we understand that and we begin to, you know, there's this process of first kind of acknowledging and then, well, one might be enduring on purpose, then receiving or embracing, and then another might be actively pursuing. There's this process of spiritual maturation that comes when we are confronted with these difficult things, wherein we more and more orient ourselves to what God is doing and cooperating, and then the graces flow. But when we do the opposite, as you might imagine, we end up in sin, despair, that sort of thing.
We're talking today with Dan Burke, author of the book Finding Peace in the Storm. When we talk about the storm, the wind and the waves, mm-hmm. we're all trying to ascend to union with God, you might say. And yeah. In your book, you talk about when we reject God's will, that can be something that paralyzes us, perhaps, when we go down the path.
Yeah, and it's funny because a devout Catholic might think, well, I don't ever reject God's will, mm-hmm. you know. But when circumstances, when the Lord brings you into a storm and you complain and you wrestle against it and you get upset and you get angry, and I'm not talking about sort of base human responses at the initial level. I'm talking about, because that's normal, right? I mean, you get in a T-boned in a car wreck, and you're injured, it hurts, and, you know, it may be life-threatening. There's all kinds of mechanisms in your body that you have to react to that in a certain way. The question is then, once you come to your senses or once you come to that moment where you have a choice, like, what am I going to do here? If you are railing against the circumstance and that's all you're focused on, so essentially you're mired in the earth and the brokenness of sin and humanity and whatever the junk is, instead of saying, what is God doing? Once you do that, you are tethered to a downward spiral by your own choice. And that could be sin of various degrees of severity. So that's what we don't want to do, but it is very understandable, very normal, natural. But the Lord gives us the strength instead, like, you know, the apostles, look in the book of Acts, they were rejoicing because they were beaten in prison. They were rejoicing because they suffered for Christ. St. Paul said, you can have a peace that passes understanding when all of your rights are taken away and you're in prison and you're going to die. And so what Alphonsus is doing is saying, this is a better way, you know, the better way to know joy and peace in the midst of the storm by joining with God instead of railing against him or rejecting what he's trying to do in your life.
And you talk about in the book, well, we all try to do good and avoid evil. But what about these times when the pursuit of good works or doing good works are actually working against us in some ways? They're displeasing to God.
Yeah, isn't that an interesting concept? He talks about that there. This is the temptation of the more mature Christian oftentimes, when we know that we have a number of goods in front of us, and but we choose one that is not God's will. And as an example, I'm married, and my primary vocation is husband, father. And so there are all kinds of goods associated with that I should do. I'm also asked, I probably turn down 50 speaking requests a year. Well, if I start accepting too many of those requests, all of which are good, all of which will help people in some way or another, if I don't turn them down and I begin to neglect my primary state, then I'm pursuing a good that isn't his will. And I'm not following him. I'm not embracing his will. So that's an example.
And when we talk about knowing God's love and hearing his voice, I think that's something, two things that all of us as Christians, as Catholics, as humans strive for.
Right.
We want to feel God's love. We want to know it's there.
Yeah.
And we desperately want to hear his voice clearly. How can we
right.
do that?
Well, Alphonsus recommends two things that one of his favorite saints recommended, which is, one is the most important to that, is daily mental prayer, where we're constantly reorienting our broken compass, our compass, because of concupiscence, every hour of every day, our compass gets a little off true north. But if every day we return to the Lord in the morning before we move out and reorient our compass to true north, we talk with him, we're spending time with him. What that does, of course, is it inflames the heart and mind toward him. It increases our love of him. And then in the context of the storm, then when you're in the storm, he's not asleep in the boat, uncaring, right, in your perception, but he's actually there, present, and able to solve any problem that you have and help you to understand whatever you need to understand. So that's really an essential element to, so there are things you can do right in the storm, right? Like listening and realizing, okay, there's a reason for this, and sort of reasoning yourself out of the negativity and the rejection of what's happening. There's things you can do outside of the storm that prepare you for the normal ebb and flow of the difficulties. And that's drawing near to Jesus in prayer. And there's no more important practice outside of the Eucharist reconciliation to do that.
And to keep this allegory or extended metaphor of finding peace in the storm or riding these waves, we all kind of encounter these moments of gigantic waves and huge wind in our lives. We all do. And we suffer humiliation, adversity, and different trials. But maybe those things can help bring about some blessings like freedom and healing and salvation. How does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly on track. These things can either become the barrier to your spiritual health in your life, or they can become the stepping stones. But it's up to you, by the power of the Holy Spirit, to say, no, I'm. This is difficult. I mean, I have a chronic lung disease. I've now lose about 4 months out of the year to ill health. And I can either sit around and whine about that, which I can tell you I have plenty of times, or I can do what the Lord's taught me to do in these latter years, is offer every hard, difficult breath up, join it with the aching breathing of Jesus on the crucifix, and allow him to magnify by his glory my meager offering into a torrent of grace on the earth for the salvation of the church and the healing of the world, for the conflicts in the Middle East, whatever it is. So then I embrace the suffering and say, this is a gift because I can know you in a way that others wouldn't know you, that don't suffer like this, and like you did on the cross, even though my suffering is nothing compared to his, but it's in like kind. And we can join together in a way that is never not possible. So it's just that shift that really makes the difference. And it just brings so much peace.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Dan Burke, author of Finding Peace in the Storm, Reflections on St. Alphonsus Liguori's Uniformity with God's Will. And we all want peace of heart in the various circumstances of life. And we all want to have that conversation with God. We want to be in love with God in this conversation. Yeah. Talk a little bit about your hope for this book in leading people down that path.
Yeah, I mean, my hope is that it's a word of hope, right? It's a different perspective. It's not commonly talked about in our time, and Liguori just is a master of this wisdom. And that folks will, one, get the tools to deal with the storms they're facing right now so they can start to shift. But then also I added some other elements in concert with his advice to how do I learn how to pray? Like most Catholics don't practice mental prayer, don't know how to. And I've got even a free film series that I was professionally produced on mental prayer that folks can find the link for in the book, to really begin to get their hearts oriented in this direction. And frankly, you and I both know things aren't getting better anytime soon. I wish it was not true, but things are getting more and more challenging in the world and even in the church. And it's really a timely, I just thought this book's got to resurface. We've got to help the people of God join with him instead of being victims of what's going on. We can be victors. We can be lights. We can show people the way.
Absolutely. And for people who want to find out more, want to pick up this book, Finding Peace in the Storm, what's the best place that people can go?
Well, always EWTN's religious catalog, but spiritualdirection.com is kind of our front door into all that we do, and there's a shop button there, and folks can click on that, and there's that and many other good books and resources.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Dan Burke, the president of the Evola Institute for Spiritual Formation and author of the new book, Finding Peace in the Storm. Thank you so much for sharing your reflections with us on today's program.
You bet. It's been great being with you.
God bless. That was Dan Burke from the Evola Institute for Spiritual Direction. Check out his new book, Finding Peace in the Storm. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio or download the EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guests today, Dan Burke, author of Finding Peace in the Storm, and Emily Jaminet, author of Secrets of the Sacred Heart. Check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural, from Tan Books and available at EWTNRC.com. And I'd like to thank you today for joining me on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.